Blog Talk Radio.
Listening to This Week in Health Innovation on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Welcome, everyone. I'm Greg Masters, the creator, producer, co-host of the show. And joining me in the virtual studio today is my colleague and co-host, Dr. Phil Marshall, co-founder and chief product officer of the innovative patient engagement and digital health checkup company, Conversa Health. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Greg. Good to be with you.
And glad you're up at this hour. This Week in Health Innovation is brought to you by Health Innovation Media, where we monitor the innovation impulse from idea to business model. On the broadcast today, we resume our focus on innovation in the emerging digital health economy with Jean Ann Booth, a serial entrepreneur with 30 years of experience in high tech. Much of what we've discussed on This Week in Health Innovation has centered on apps, software, or cloud-based platforms or business models. And on this broadcast, we're diving into a hardware play and the value prop of the Life Assist technology recently tagged as wearable OnStar for seniors. Life Assist is a GN's fourth startup company, and her background spans from P&L business unit management to marketing, product definition, systems software and applications engineering, silicon development engineering, and operations and product engineering. She founded Luminary Micro, the creators of Stellaris microcontroller MCU platform, and the first to market with ARM Cortex M3-based microcontroller solutions. Jean Ann holds a BSEE from the University of Texas and an MSCE degree from the National Technical University. With that as a quick pass intro, Phil, over to you. Help us to get to know this tech entrepreneur.
Absolutely. And Jean, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Phil. It's a real pleasure to be here.
And I know that you're in Austin, Texas, which is a sort of burgeoning technology area. I had the pleasure of being there for South by Southwest last year for the tech edition of that show, and was really impressed by all of the Texans that came out. And so I see that you have had a great experience being an entrepreneur and a technologist. I couldn't for the life of me recite most of the things that Greg just said because I don't know what many of them mean, but I'm looking forward to learning about your experience as an entrepreneur. I'm eager, and I think our audience will be as well, to hear about the senior market and their use of technology. And so let's just get right into it. So Life Assist, wearable OnStar for seniors, certainly an interesting product that my understanding is uses internet technology to help seniors stay connected and safe. And so maybe what you could do for us is just give us a little bit of background of the company and then also help us to understand that market a little bit and what that looks like.
Absolutely. My pleasure. So I wouldn't really expect most of the listeners of this broadcast today to understand a lot of what we talked about in the bio because my background is 30 years in semiconductors. And so only if you're in semiconductors would any of that make any sense. But after the previous startups that I started, sold to Texas Instruments and Apple, I actually started Life Assist because my mother is 80, and she's just not willing to wear today's emergency alert products, nor do they actually provide the full complement of assistance that she needs to live independently. And that's what I really want for her, is to be able to live independently and also with dignity. So that little tagline, wearable OnStar for seniors, actually came from some of our focus groups as they were looking at the products that we're building and what they do. And because we help seniors when they're hurt, lost, or forgetful, it was one of the focus group participants who said, oh, it's like OnStar for people. So we're taking all of the technology that we know and packaging it up in a traditional-looking watch so that we can combine cellular capability, Wi-Fi, and GPS so that we can give our senior population an active medical alert that works anywhere, along with a data-driven artificial intelligence. And what we do with that is to actually learn the wearer's lifestyle. We actually combine that with an easy-to-use speech interface so that we can provide discrete support for falls, medication reminders, and as a guard against wandering.
You know, the senior market, I think, is fascinating. You hear people talk about it, and really it's all hypothetical for most of us, you know, that seniors don't use technology. Or no, seniors do use technology, and they are using technology, but there has to be tablets. And it's all hypothetical for most of us. But for you, you're in the trenches. So help us understand, what is the reality of seniors and their use of technology, their connectedness, their use of the Internet? What's the reality?
I think the first thing you have to talk about is, what are you going to define as somebody who's a senior? You know, certainly the AARP is taking everybody 50-plus and making us all seniors. And a lot of times when we talk about seniors and technology, what we're really talking about is that first wave of baby boomers in the senior population. So when you look at that, 53% of baby boomers are on Facebook, and 41% of Apple's customers are baby boomers. 45% of the people 65 to 74 years of age exercise regularly. And they're very active travelers. In fact, the whole road trip creation kind of came from that boomer generation. But it's a very different marketplace when you look at the seniors who are currently 70 up. And again, I said my mom is 80. And so it's a different place that they are in. They tend to be on Facebook, at least a lot of them are, but less than 20% of them have a smartphone. And that changes very much what it is that you can do on a product basis if you're trying to help somebody to live independently like we're doing.
And so you're really kind of utilizing wearables that are connected, sort of getting into that idea of the Internet of Things, that things are simply connected. They just are. That's the reality. And so here you're talking about a watch, as I understand it, that can be activated and communicated with by voice, that's always connected with GPS. And so this seems to sort of get at that idea of just really low burden, light touch, but sort of always there for you, kind of idea that not just seniors want. I think pretty much everybody wants that idea. So tell us a little bit about the applicability of your technology to the non-senior market.
Certainly, the technology can be used in the non-senior market as personal safety devices, because as a wearable device, as a watch, it's always with you. As medication reminders for any population that has a regular medication component in their life, and as a guard against wandering for some of the special needs populations as well. So, yeah.
Okay, and as people think about the Internet of Things and our world and everything around us being connected at all times, what sort of unique insights have you gotten when it comes to objects that we wear being connected, especially for those who are, what do they call them, digital immigrants and not digital natives?
Exactly.
Yeah, so how does connectivity of everyday objects sort of change someone's life, especially for somebody who's not quite used to it?
You know, it can be a little bit frightening. And so, you know, when you talk about the senior market, especially from my perspective, seniors being 75 plus in general, there are a couple of things that really drive aspects of their lives and their behaviors. They tend not to like technology, not because technology is not useful, but because technology makes them feel stupid. And above all, you know, having lived a long and fruitful life, you don't want to be wandering around all the time showing everybody that you're stupid, right? Another aspect that goes into that is in this population, especially, the things that they fear most are having to move into a nursing home. 13% fear that above all else, and 26% fear losing control of their independent life above all else. So less than 3% of seniors in that age bracket actually fear death. So it's all about control, and that's where the digital immigrant part of the world is, and what happens when you're talking about the Internet of Things. It's about privacy. It's about control. And in this population, it becomes about dignity.
That's a really interesting perspective. And so technology making people feel stupid is a really interesting point, I think. And what it sounds like you're trying to do is to really make it so that it's working for them and allows them to not feel like they're stupid or trying to figure something out that's complicated, but rather supporting them, their dignity, and their lifestyle. I think it's fascinating. Now, there's a lot. I think it's going to be the understatement, at least of the week, to say that there's a lot happening in the wearable space.
Yeah.
Let's just kind of go with that for a minute. So recently, a little company out of Cupertino announced their health kit, and that got a lot of attention. Prior to that, Samsung had announced that they had an active health-related effort underway, and then even more recently, Google once again back in the fray after their initial failed attempt at Google Health to support this notion of consumer-centric healthcare. First of all, let's paint the landscape a little bit of consumer or patient-centric healthcare versus what historically has been perhaps a more paternalistic, perhaps provider-centric or payer-centric healthcare system, where the EMR has been king for the last 10 years, and now it seems like more and more effort around the consumer taking control of their own health and owning and managing their own health information on their own behalf. Help us paint that ecosystem. What's happening when it comes to consumer-centric healthcare? And speak, if you could, specifically to what are these big players doing and what impact do you think it'll have?
So I think we're in the midst of a first transition, and I don't think this is going to be our final evolution. But the first transition that I see is a model in which, you know, that kind of paternalistic model, that's your electronic health record that your health company and your doctor, you're supposed to have rights to it, but primarily they're the only ones who have rights to it, and it's pretty hard to get that information back out. The changes that are occurring, and you see this with Apple's HealthKit and some of the other initiatives that have been recently announced, are to be able to create a rich set of data in a person's own electronic health record. So it's your personal health record. And you can combine that with devices like the wearables that we have to actually begin to see something useful in telehealth in the United States. So you could actually have a blood pressure monitor at home that then takes data that we can pass through the watch to the cloud, and that becomes a part of your personal health record. Now, your doctor could look at that too, but it's the data that you took at home. You didn't have to go into the office to see them. Same thing with, you know, glucose monitoring and other home health care requirements. So
Jean-Ann, it brings up a really interesting question. For those of us who were, gaining a lot of scar tissue back in the early 2000s on personal health records. And I was part of the Connecting for Health initiative sponsored by the Markle Foundation and was there sort of arm in arm with Microsoft and Google and others as we were trying to forge that early space. But it largely, at least from a sort of consumer-owned health record being sort of a dominant entity in healthcare. It failed on that point. It succeeded on some other points in being an infrastructure to WebMD's employer and payer business. Microsoft Health Vault's still sort of seemingly limping along, at least. But Google Health, which was probably the most visible of all of them, led by my friend Adam Bosworth, did not succeed at that time. So why would now be different when it comes to consumers wanting this kind of service? You know, I'll just segue briefly and say that I asked Lygia Ricciardi of ONC the same question, and that is, we've been doing this now for a while. A lot of patients have had access to their longitudinal health record, at least through their provider, for a while. Are the benefits being realized? Are all of those things that we hypothesized about as the benefits of controlling your own health data being realized, or are we still speculating?
I think we're actually still in the beginning of that transition, and I think one of the differences is, you said it, but you didn't emphasize it, and that is the personal health record was actually kind of controlled more by the provider. So things that have changed since that original initiative is, it's now possible for consumers to have cloud data and cloud accounts, and that interoperability between consumer devices has finally become at a point to where you could use a service like Validic to actually share the data from your Fitbit or the data from, a Nike Fuel Band or some device along those lines, actually into a personal health record. And the challenge is, it can't be owned by a provider. It has to actually be something that is owned by the person. And that's when it becomes successful.
So we're still sort of speculating about that, because personal health records that aren't within the provider don't today have access to their data across the continuum of care. But certainly that's the vision behind the Blue Button initiative in particular. And it sounds like you and your efforts are right in line with that. I want to transition for a moment and talk a little bit about having a startup. And having a startup in the healthcare technology space. Now, you've had several startups. You've gone through the cycle several times. I found a quote of yours from a couple of years ago when you were interviewed by the Austin technology publication Silicon Hills. And you said, you have to be able to deal with the fact that one day it's a great day and the next day we're dead. It's a great day, then we're dead. It's a great day, then we're dead. I'll tell you that resonated with me because I think if you're in the startup world, you're looking for funding, you're in pilot, you're getting off the ground, you're looking for more clients, you're looking for more support, that it can be some of the hardest work that you can ever imagine. And I myself often second-guess both myself and have provided advice to others to just tread carefully, especially if you're bootstrapping. And so as you've gone through this several times, help us to better understand what your experience has been as an entrepreneur. Help us to understand what that startup lifestyle is like for those who might not be used to it, whether because they've been in a big company and had sort of the comforts of that for a while, or not. Help us understand what it's like to go back in and do it again.
Sure. You know, when I sold my last company to Texas Instruments, one of the things that everybody asked me was, you know, are you going to start another company? And I said, well, you know, not right now, but the odds are pretty good I probably will. And some of what drives that is, you know, having an idea, having a passion for that idea, and having the tenacity to see that it is something that actually will make a difference. And in my particular case, those products need to make a difference in the world. That's the difference between, you know, scientists and engineers. You're making products that people use, and I want them to be delighted by using our products. So when you think about actually starting a company, we've gone through a wave in the media where it's once again really sexy to be an entrepreneur. They don't really tell you the downside parts, but I think the best summary is that part that says, you know, every decision is a company buster. One day it's a great day, the next day you're dead. And you really have to be able to weather that emotional storm, and you must have tenacity with a capital T. I could even say that it's stubbornness. You absolutely have to believe in what you're doing and know that it's going to make a difference because, speaking of no's, there's nobody who gets no's like an entrepreneur who's fundraising.
Yeah, well, absolutely right. And so that fundraising bit, the money part of it, let's talk about that. People, I think, who are entrepreneurs and who are idea-driven, like it sounds like you and I may share that trait, that the money part is a part that either on the one hand we feel like will just come because, after all, it's a great idea, so the money should follow, or it's a barrier and we don't feel like we can even really get started because, after all, we don't really have the startup or bootstrap capital to do so. And so as entrepreneurs, especially in the healthcare technology space that does have more legacy issues to have to deal with, frankly, than some other industries, how would you advise them on dealing with that startup capital issue?
Wow. you know, I things have changed a lot. So my first startup company was back in the 90s, and because my startup companies were semiconductor companies, but that's big money raising. So I've raised over $84 million in venture capital in my past companies. But I can tell you that things have changed in the financial market significantly, and raising money has been much more challenging than I expected for this particular company. So I think the only thing I can say is, you know, you do have to be self-aware if you're going to be an entrepreneur, and you have to keep asking yourself, I believe in this. I believe in this idea. In our particular case at Life Assist, I know that we can make a positive difference for over 20 million seniors in the United States who could live independently. But you also have to be willing and able to ask yourself, am I wrong? Or have I just not found the person who sees the vision, shares the vision, and wants to come with us as we build a company that makes life better while also becoming profitable too?
Yeah, so this is all such an important topic for so many people. Is the timing right? Is the product right? How much validation do you have? How much validation do you need? How much capital do you need? I was advised a couple of years ago before I started the video technology company JumperCut, a whole space, you know, video technology that I had not been in before, so didn't have credentials there, that if you're going to do something that really goes out in front quite a ways, make sure that you have a technology co-founder, because otherwise that's where so much of your cash is going to go. And so they need to be vested, they need to be unpaid, right? And so you need to get product done without having that that cash sink. And, you know, looking back on it, it's, you know, we've been able to grow and transition and pivot now to healthcare, back to healthcare technology pretty successfully with having engineers that weren't on the co-founder sort of status. But what's your reaction to that? Do you agree that having somebody who can do the technology right there with you and without having to pay them is an essential or even required ingredient?
I think it probably depends upon the business. I guess the thing to say when you're talking about a startup company and you're talking about funding and you're talking about, you know, questioning whether or not you've got the right vision, whether you call it a pivot or not, the thing that distinguishes a startup from kind of a larger entity is that in a startup, whatever the barrier is, you find a way around it. You go under it, you go around it, you go over it, you just change the direction completely. You just never really let anything become a roadblock for you. And so if the technology is that important to where you have to have a technology co-founder who is working on that technology, then that's what you need to have. In our particular case with Life Assist, we do have both systems and software co-founders in this company. They're both folks who've been with me in multiple companies before, and the technology is pretty important to us. But do you always have to have that? I think it depends on what it is you're building.
Okay, fair enough. So let's now sort of look ahead a little bit and look outward. You've been exposed to the Startup Health group, which for our audience, if they're not familiar, Startup Health is an ecosystem of companies. Now about, I think about 70 companies. Conversa Health is one. Life Assist is another. And in fact, Unity Stokes, one of the leaders of that ecosystem, will actually be our guest on this program next week. And so as Jeanne-Anne, as you look at this ecosystem, Startup Health or otherwise, of startups in healthcare, what is it outside of, you know, the wearable space that you're in and what you're doing, what is it that excites you most? What is it that you think has some of the best opportunity for a return on investment for benefiting people in their lives? What are some of the things that you're seeing out there that excite you the most?
Oh my God, and I can't pick my own company?
I'm sorry. We already talked about Life Assist quite a bit. You have to do something else.
Oh goodness. You know, I'm not sure I can answer your question. There's so many great things that I'm seeing people work on. But because I didn't have a prior health background, I don't understand enough about the details of what's really going on. I do know that from my own experience as a consumer, the things that I see at Startup Health that I find to be very exciting are the activities that some of the companies are doing with respect to being able to provide companies with more cost-effective ways of managing health populations, and what we can do as a group to help create a financial and business environment where it's in everybody's best interest to invest in your long-term health. And so let me talk about that for just a second, because one of the things that we did during Health Data Palooza, that was the quarterly meeting of the Startup Health companies that are in the Academy, and one of the things we did was we went to the White House and we had a meeting with some of the healthcare policy staffers, which was an incredible experience. You know, I had heard that there are people in the government who are as passionate as we entrepreneurs are about our businesses, but I'd never seen it before that day, and it was just really phenomenal to see. And one of the things we ended up talking about was, you know, what kind of policies, what kind of governmental encouragement do we need to put in place to build a system where we're encouraging the payers to invest in your long-term health, whether that's going to be, you know, behavior modification technology, whether it might be your doctor actually taking that personal health record with all of the data from your Fitbit and saying, you know, good job, Jeanne-Anne, you did 10,000 steps every single day for the last 6 months. You know, all of that kind of stuff that then goes back to, and as a result, we're going to decrease your premium because you've done the things that invest in your long-term health. And it was just, it was really an interesting experience. And so all of the technologies and companies that we have in Startup Health, those who are working on improving the experience in healthcare overall, those are the ones that I think are really, really amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so really whether it's payers or providers or direct to consumer, really reaching out to the consumer and effectively supporting their decisions, helping them to make better choices, helping them have safety and support as in Life Assist, areas that you really are most excited and encouraged about, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's certainly an area of a lot of activity. A lot of folks have yet to really prove that space out, but there's a lot of investment activity in a lot of companies that are going after that space. And so as we sort of wrap up here, I think that gives us some really good food for thought on what is the what's the role of the consumer in this next 10 years versus the last 10 years? What's the role of wearables? What's the role of Internet of Things? And will the big consumer players transform that space into being predominant over and above the provider-centric space? As we sort of wrap up here, I'll just say that in the provider-centric space, that Farzad Wasashari just launched a new company that is provider-centric. And in fact, his statement on his website is his new company puts doctors back in control of healthcare. So we'll see exactly how the patient-facing and the provider-facing arenas intersect and hopefully complement each other. Gene, Anne, it was a wonderful experience having you on the show, and best of luck with your venture, Life Assist.
Thank you very much, Phil. Greg, it was a pleasure being here today.
And that'll have to be the last word for today's broadcast. I want to thank our guest, Jean Ann Booth, the founder, CEO of Life Assist. Follow her on Twitter at Jean Ann Booth, JeanAnneBooth, as well as Wear Life Assist on Twitter. And check her out on the web as well. This is Greg Masters telling you that we do this weekly, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Join us next week for another episode of This Week in Health Innovation. Greg Masters saying bye now.